Good morning. We are going to continue in our series today about creation. Yet my Bible is turned to Isaiah, so that's probably not right. I guess we could do something. There's probably something in creation in there. We're going to be in day three today. So thus far, we've covered day one and day two. And I was looking at the calendar, and next week we'll cover day four, and then our district superintendent will be coming the next week to preach and deliver a message. And I don't know if I've ever heard him preach. I've heard him speak at some of our district events, but from what I've been told, he is an excellent, excellent preacher. He's been in ministry for many years. He's been really great for our district, for our denomination, and I'm excited to have him down here. It's November 3rd, I think it's the Sunday that he'd be here. And then we'll pick up the remaining 3 days of creation coming back, and that'll take us almost into December. Crazy that we're already getting in that time frame. Elizabeth was right. If you don't buy your candy now, it's already going to be Christmas. And then it's going to be Valentine's Day, just like that. So better jump in there. Today in day three, there's going to be more separation taking place. We've seen this pattern where God creates and then God separates, and that's what's happening today. And ultimately what today's about is creating plants, and we got some plant lovers in the house. I'm one of them. Plants would be needed in order to sustain animal and human life. And so what we're going to see today is these plants were made to reproduce and to cover the earth. I was already thinking about this sermon after I finished my sermon last week, and it kind of has set up unintentionally. This is how I know, like, I'm a pastor at my core. Each week we focused on a different, I would say, one key theme. The first week was about God's presence. Last week was about preparation. Today is going to be about production. They all started with P, accidentally. So we'll see if that continues the rest of the series. That was not intentional, but today is going to be about production. The Bible does talk about us producing as followers of Jesus. It talks about producing fruit. Also part of that producing that we're called to do is to make disciples, to share the gospel with other people. And before I get into exactly what that looks like for us and how it relates to what God did at creation, I want to tell you what the trends in America look like. We are not producing very well. As a nation, we continue to degrade morally. And we can blame the political parties, we can blame all these other things, but ultimately, I think it comes down to the church no longer being the moral compass that God has called us to be. No longer being the salt and light that God has called us to be. And because we have forfeited that position here in our nation continues to morally degrade, and we continue to see crazy things being taught that are right that are actually wrong. We effectively live in what scholars would call a post-Christian nation. And a lot of the stuff I read mentions how we're in a post-Christian nation. And what exactly does that mean? It basically means that we live in a nation where people don't want to hear about Jesus. People don't want to go to church. It used to not be this way. Those of you that are older, you know there was a time where most of the people in this area would be in church on Sunday morning. Our churches would be full or close to full. Things were different. That was when we were more of a semi-Christian nation. Today, though, people don't want to go to church, they don't want to hear about Jesus, and they don't believe in God. Whose fault is that? Ours. It's the church's fault. We aren't reaching people with the gospel or making disciples of Jesus like we should. I'm a big stats guy. I love numbers. And so here's a number. This is from Pew Research Center. And this study was called The Rise of the Nuns. And not N-U-N-S. It's not like a bunch of nuns are going to come and get us. These are N-O-N-E-S. And these are people who are religiously unaffiliated. This was the number of Christians. So this goes back to 1972. I wasn't even a thought then. And around 90% of people in America identified as Christians. And people who was religiously unaffiliated was around 5%. Now look at the trend going all the way up to about 2017, around 2018. and 63% identified as Christians, but the nuns are rising big time. The other religions are staying about even. Christianity is in decline. Those that don't want to identify with any religion are heading up. Here's another one. This was done by Barna. I love the studies that Barna does. This one goes back to 2000. And it divided the numbers between practicing Christians, so they had to attend church, I think, three or two plus times a month and read their Bible, tithe, that type of thing, non-practicing Christians and non-Christians. And you can see in 2000, about 45% of Americans were practicing Christians. Another 35% were non-practicing Christians. 45 plus 35 is 80, right, Randy? Right. That was a little bit slow. You should have said right and just gone with it. Because then the next number is 20, and 80 plus 20 is 100. I do know that much. So you see the numbers there. That's all right. Now, it's still concerning that only 45% of Americans were practicing Christians. Because when I'm really looking at it, I don't know people's heart. But what we measure here on people who are spiritually mature is if they are a practicing Christian and practicing the things that we look for in Christians. I'm worried about the 35%. But look how these numbers change. This was an interesting time frame, 2012. So we just came out of the crash, the financial crisis in 08. I thought there'd be a big increase here in 01 because what I was told is the churches were full right after 9/11. But you don't see that type of increase. Maybe a little bit in 03 went up to 47%. But ultimately, in 2012, we see it really mixed. That's when we see practicing Christians become the minority and non-practicing Christians become the majority. And that's how it ultimately was in 2020. Now it says only 25% of Americans are practicing Christians, 43% are non-practicing, and 32% are non-Christian. We have work to do if that's the case. I got a feeling if you look at the trends, this number's probably on down there right now if we hadn't a 2024 study done. Whose fault is that? It's our fault. We're not producing disciples like God has called us to produce. And that has got to change. So as we work through day three, we'll look at some truths from creation to apply to how we are called to produce as well. Putting our mind back into the beginning. So day one, God created the heavens and the earth. And at that point, we think he created heavenly paradise and the solar system. Day two is what we looked at last week. He separates the waters from the waters, and he creates what we believe is Earth's atmosphere. At this point, the Earth is still covered in water. And when I think about the Earth covered in water, I imagine it looked kind of like the ocean. But when God created the Earth, that included the soil, and that included the dirt. So really, the earth at this point is a muddy type water, very messy water. I thought about some of the pictures we saw come out of Western North Carolina where it's just, you know, muddy water rushing down through there, and then especially like after the waters have done gone, now it's just mud. They step into it and it goes up to their knee or even higher in many places. That's kind of what earth is like, except it's more watery than that at this point. And so now, let's read verses 9 and 10. God said, "Let the waters below the heavens be gathered into one place, and let the dry land appear." And it was so. And God called the dry land earth, and the gathering of the waters he called seas. And God saw that it was good. So on day three, God forms the foundation for life by moving the water to the seabed and therefore forming dry land. So we're told that God has gathered the sea, the water, into one place, and he calls that seas. Some think that at this time there was just one ocean. And when you think about it, there really is just one seabed. We just named different parts of it. The seabed is an area of land that is lower than that around it. So the water, naturally, because of the laws that God has set up, is going to go to where the land is lowest. God does name them seas, so there could be multiple seas at this point. But still, there is one seabed. As God formed the seas, the land appeared. Notice it doesn't say God created the land. It says, because the land was already created. It says when God said the waters below be gathered into one place and let the dry land appear. The land was just hidden by the water. So now the changes that had to take place, the tectonic changes that had to take place in order for this to happen were massive. I imagine parts of the earth moving up, making our mountains, because I had this thought, were the mountains in existence? And Noah does mention that the sea rose above the mountains. So mountains probably were existed at this point. And then other parts of the land went down. And the water naturally went from the high part to the low part and formed the sea. This, at this point, creationists, and these were people who believe in the Bible but also look at it from a scientific perspective, they believe a supercontinent was formed called Rodinia. I knew you were going to say Pangea, Randy. I set you up for that one. Called Rodinia. I have never heard of Rodinia before. Rodinia, this was one of the pictures that I saw of Rodinia. Rodinia comes before Pangea. Pangea comes after the flood. Rodinia comes before. This was one of the pictures I saw. Obviously, we don't know exactly what it looks like. But from what I read, creationists, creation scientists, believes that it was basically one landmass. And my understanding was that there was no divide at all. It was just all together. So that picture is not even perfect, and I think it did come from a science website, because even scientists do mention Rodinia. What I was reading, the scholars believe that Rodinia was broken up when the great flood happened. Because in Genesis 7:11, it says, on that day, all the fountains of the great deep burst open. So in a way, what it's saying is that at that point, the land began to separate, and the fountains of the deep, the water, came forth. So you had rain both falling from the sky and coming up from the ground. And at that point, Rodinia would have been separated. And eventually, Pangea would come after the flood, after the land probably shifted back together a little bit, but it has changed at that point. Now, do we know this is true? I don't know. I just thought it was interesting, and I thought I'd mention it to you. I don't claim to be an expert in this, but when I read this, I've never heard of Rodinia before, and then you type in Rodinia on Google, and a lot comes up. So it is something that they do talk about. But the key point here is that when God sent the oceans to the seabed, it forms the land. In Western North Carolina, once the water went away, that was just a muddy mess there. That's what they're dealing with now. But what does Scripture tell us appeared? Dry land. This land has never seen whatever the light source is at this point, because it's not the sun. This land has never seen that light before. And yet, as soon as it comes up, dry land appeared. And God called the dry land earth. That in itself was an amazing act. It's not a muddy mess. Have you ever tried sowing grass in a muddy mess? It doesn't work very good. Have you ever tried planting stuff in a muddy mess? My yard stays muddy all the time, pretty much. It's not fun. Instead, this is dry land, dry fertile land, in fact, that would serve as the foundation, and that's the word that I want to hit on, that would serve as the foundation for plants to be planted. When we talk about foundation, we have to understand that God is the foundation for us to spiritually produce in this world. If we are a plant that is being planted in order to produce fruit, we are planted in the soil of Jesus Christ. He is the one that serves as our foundation. He's done everything we needed in order to produce life. Number one, we wouldn't have life without God, both physically and spiritually. If God didn't choose for you to be created, you would not be here today. If God didn't choose for you to be able to follow him, you're spiritually alive today. He has made a way for all those who will call on the name of the Lord to be saved. We have life because of him. Not only that, but God has created us with the ability to play a role in bringing others to spiritual life in Christ. When you produce things that are going to help other people. Our youth are going through a study right now on spiritual gifts. And this past week, they went around and they were asking different people in the church at that time what we saw some of their gifts are, what are areas of strengths that they might not realize they have, that type of thing. And I thought that was great for our youth to be talking about. How has God gifted us to be able to help other people, to be able to play a role in producing in this world and in our church? Because ultimately, God has prepared us to produce. When you talk about plants, you got to set them up to produce. Once you set them up, though, it's their job to produce. And when they don't do what they're supposed to do, we end up taking them back to Lowe's, returning them, like we've done with the azalea bushes out front here at the church that just will not do what they're supposed to do. Have we went through 3 azalea bushes out here? 6, technically. We went through 6 azalea bushes out front here because, for some reason, they don't like that soil. We're doing everything we need to do, but they're not working. Now, I love it when my plants at my house, they do what they're supposed to do. I think God loves it when he sets us up in the right soil, around the right people, and we produce what we're supposed to produce. He loves to see that, just like we love to see our plants bloom. But when things are not working out right, when he has set us up, and he has set us up, and we're not producing, he tells us a parable of what happens then. And it's serious. This parable is told in Matthew chapter 25. And you may have heard it called the parable of the talents. Other versions will call it the parable of the gold or the parable of the money. In the translation I'm using, which is the NIV translation, I believe it's the parable of the gold. And in this parable, a man gives his servants bags of gold. One got 5 bags, one got 2, and one got 1. The one that got 5 took that 5 and got 5 more. The one that got 2 took those 2 and took 2 more. But the one who got 1 took it and buried it, and it didn't gain anymore. He didn't use it for anything good. And the comparison here is that God has given us gifts, talents, abilities, and ultimately life. And the question is, what do we do with them? Do we use them to gain more? And not necessarily more talent and abilities. It does say, though, if God gives you something and you use it, he will give you more. But ultimately, do we use it to bring more into his kingdom? Or do we bury it like that last man did? Based off the trends that we looked at, I wonder if we're burying our gifts and abilities that God has given us. Here's what Jesus said, or the master says, to the one that buried them. His master replied, "You wicked and lazy servant." They say this is one of the things that's come over the American church today, is that we're lazy. And we're seeing some wicked stuff take place too. I do think we are lazy. We've got to get out and do something. Here's what he says. "So you knew that I harvest where I've not sown and gather where I've not scattered seed. Well then, you should have put my money on deposit with the banker so that when I returned it, I would have received it back with interest. So take the bag of gold from him and give it to the one who has 10 bags. For whoever has will be given more, and they will have an abundance. Whoever does not have, even what they have will be taken from them." And then listen to this consequence. "Throw that worthless servant outside into the darkness where there'll be weeping and gnashing of teeth." And then God said, "Let the earth..." Oh, now we're in Genesis. Just kidding. I just kept on reading. What came to my mind as I was reading that just then was that stat that we looked at of non-practicing Christians. People who are not practicing the faith. And I don't know exactly what their criteria was for that, but people who claim to be Christians and God has given them abilities and gifts to use for the glory of God, and they're not using it. I'm afraid they're going to hear that one day. Throw that worthless servant outside into the darkness where there'll be weeping and gnashing of teeth. I will go as far to say, I wonder if these people are not really Christians. God knows their hearts ultimately, but that concerns me as a pastor. That is something that we have got to work on. And my job as the pastor of this church is to make sure you are not in that category. Are you using your gifts for the glory of God? God has formed the foundation for you to spiritually produce. He's given you what you need. It's on you to do something with it. It's on you to apply it and use your gifts and abilities for God's glory. Now let's read Genesis 1, 11 through 13. Then God said, "Let the earth sprout vegetation, plants yielding seed and fruit trees on the earth bearing fruit according to their kind with seed in them." And it was so. The earth produced vegetation, plants yielding seed according to their kind, and trees bearing fruit with seed in them according to their kind. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening, and there was morning, a third day. This is one of the days where God lists two times that what he created was good. We talked about last week, in day two, it's the only day where he doesn't say it's good. This time he said it's good twice. So he created the seas and created the land, and now he's created plants. And he said it was good. And so at this point, the Lord creates mature plants that would reproduce according to their species. We read that and we see there's, it lists three different types of plants that God created that day. And I've never really thought about that. I just thought about plants being created, but it does list three different types of plants. The first one that was listed was vegetation. Some commentators used to think that this referred to grass. Nowadays, they believe it generally represents just general vegetation. You will see, though, the way that they define the vegetation, the plants, and the fruit trees are all about how it reproduces or what seed is present or not present. So the reason why they would have used the word vegetation is because in grass, the grass I have at home, I can't readily see the seeds. Some vegetables, you can't readily see the seeds. Sometimes they're inside of things. So this first thing, whatever it was that was created, was something where you can't really see the seeds. The second one, there were plants yielding seeds. So these are ones where the seeds would have been visible. These are not trees, so they're not quite that big. But this would have included a wide variation of plants that the seeds would be able to reproduce. And then you had the fruit trees. These would have been the bigger plants, and they have fruit in them. Now with fruit, a lot of times you got to cut it open in order to see the seeds that are inside that need to be planted. The way that these things were defined was all about where the seed was and how those plants would reproduce. Now these plants, notice that these plants were created yielding seed according to its kind and bearing fruit. In other words, these plants were created as mature. So when you ask which came first, the chicken or the egg, we don't ask this question, but which came first, the seed or the tree? It was the tree that came first. Technically, they came at the same time, but the tree came first to then put the seed down. These trees were already, these plants were already bearing fruit. And you're going to see this pattern happen. And this is why, this is one of those theories where the old earth versus new earth type thing. Our timeline, so when scientists measure how old the earth is, they use it based off our understanding of UV rays and all that type of science-y junk. But what if God created an already old earth? So the earth isn't old in, like, our years, but if he's creating trees that are already mature, he does not create Adam as a baby. Adam's already mature, and what if, and he creates the animals already mature, what if he created the earth already mature, and it throws the scientists all off? There's something to think about. That's one of the theories that I kind of think about and go with, and we'll probably cover that more in the next few weeks. But this was the first hint of that. He's created mature plants that are already bearing fruit. Now, it says that they'll bear seed according to their kind. The word for kind there means species. So apple trees will produce apples, lemon trees will produce lemons, strawberry plants will produce strawberries, etc., etc. Yet, in all of these plants, there's probably a genetic complexity that enables other types within those species to be created. One of the commentaries I read said that God probably didn't create Red Delicious apples and Granny Smith apples and Honeycrisp apples and so on and so forth. He probably created an apple tree, but within that apple tree, it contained the genetic complexity in order to create all these other. You go to the grocery store down today, and there's a ton of different types of apples, tons of different types of fruits, and all types of things. God, in his wisdom, created this stuff at that point with that genetic complexity. And so these plants were ultimately there to produce food for the animals and humans that would come later. And also with that one, I think plants are pretty. And when you talk about our earth going from a muddy, water-covered mess to now beautiful green vegetation and plants appearing, can you imagine how amazed the angels were at that point as they're witnessing this? I love to go into a garden that is really beautiful. At this point, the earth is really beautiful. And the angels, I would think, are just praising God. So the plants produce food and beauty. They would produce seeds as a way of reproducing. And even in death, plants return their nutrients to the soil. Another thing I read was that today we consider a plant alive. They didn't then. They didn't consider it as a part of life because it doesn't have a soul. So that's something else to think about. But I want to take those three things, food slash beauty, seeds, and even in death, returning nutrients to the soil. I want to take those three things and talk about what we as followers of Jesus are called to produce. The first thing we're called to produce is goodness in this world. When I think about goodness in this world, let's give the world something to munch on that tastes good. There's a lot of stuff in this world that is nasty, that you don't like looking at, that makes you sad, makes you depressed. Let's give the world something good. And let's make the world a little bit prettier of a place. Here's the way Jesus in John 15 describes this goodness. He describes it as fruit. Jesus says, "I am the vine and you are the branches. If you remain in me and I in you, you will bear much fruit. But apart from me, you can do nothing." So he's the vine. When we talk about Jesus being the foundation, a branch can't produce anything without the vine, without the bulk of the tree. And so he is the vine, we are the branches, we connect with him, and if we connect with him, we will bear much fruit. So what is that fruit? Well, here's what Jesus says in John 15, 16 through 17. He said, "You did not choose me, but I chose you and appointed you so that you might go and bear fruit, fruit that will last." We'll get to that in the last point. "So that you, whatever you ask in my name, the Father will give you." And then he says simply this, "This is my command, love each other." When you talk about the fruit that Jesus has enabled us to produce, it is described by that word, love. If we as Christians are living the way that we should be living, we are going to be loving other people and making this world a little bit of a better place. If a Christian is living the way they should be living, they're going to make their workplace a better place to work because they sacrificially love and they work hard. They're going to make the cashier or waitress's day better because they are nice, they're friendly, and they're giving. Sunday after church should not be the time in which waitresses do not want to work. That should be the one time they want to work because they earn the most money because Christians are the most giving. Christians who are living the way they should be living are going to make their school a better place because they treat others the way they want to be treated. And ultimately, if we live the way we are called to live, we are going to be a positive influence in society, in our families, and in our world. trying to think of a story to communicate this, and God took me to one of my favorite movies, but I know it's ultimately a book, from one of my favorite writers, one of the greatest Christian writers of all time, C.S. Lewis. And the story I want to tell to communicate this point is from the Chronicles of Narnia, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. I remember, I think we went on a field trip, actually, to watch that movie when it came out. And even then, as I don't know how old I was, but even then, I recognized the Christian truths that were present in that movie. Because C.S. Lewis, a Christian writer, he had a way of telling fictional stories, but communicating spiritual truths through them. And you're going to see one of those spiritual truths as I tell this story. How many of you have watched the Chronicles of Narnia or read the book? Yeah, most of us. So you know that when the kids, they go through the wardrobe and they come into Narnia. And at this point, Narnia is covered in winter. And the reason why it is covered in winter is because the White Witch has become queen. Aslan is this wonderful lion. I've introduced Elijah to the Lion King this past week, but we didn't start with the first one. We started with 1.5 because it's funny. But I thought about watching this, actually, but I figured this was probably too complex for him. But this is Aslan, and Aslan is this grand lion which mirrors Jesus in Narnia. Now, the reason why the White Witch and Winter is there is because Aslan is not there. The White Witch would represent Satan, the forces of darkness. The reason why Aslan is not there is because Aslan wants to rule through people, human beings, in Narnia. He doesn't have the human beings to rule through, so in that vacuum of leadership, the White Witch has come into power. So you enter the children, the four children. They come into Narnia. Narnia is covered in winter, this lifeless winter. The animals are suffering under the queen's reign. But eventually, they make their journey through Narnia, and they get to a part, and if I remember correctly, it's a waterfall and a river, and I think the wolves are chasing after them. And they're trying to cross the river, but the river starts breaking up, and spring is starting to spring forth there in Narnia, and they ask why, and the animals tell them it's because Aslan is near. See, where Jesus is, there is life. That was communicated in Narnia, where the lion was, it brought life. It thawed out the winter and brought goodness into that area. So he has come back now to Narnia, to that area. Why? Because he has humans that he can reign through. And the way that Narnia ends is they defeat the White Witch, and the four children are crowned as kings and queens of Narnia, and Aslan goes off. Do you see the similarities between that story and the story of really the history of the world? God is looking for kings and queens, human beings, to rule his creation, to be kings and queens over this creation. And it should be where we are, because we have the power that works through Jesus. There should be life. Don't you know that this world is covered in a proverbial winter? Seems like everything around us is just bad and lifeless. We're about to head into the winter season here. I love when spring comes around and you see all the new life coming about. That's the way it should be when you walk into a room. When you walk into a room, you should bring life with you. Why? Because you have Jesus with you. Because Jesus lives within you. So you should be making Facebook a better place, your workplace a better place, your home a better place, your school a better place, so on and so forth. You should be making them a better place simply because you are there. That should be something that is produced through you. The second thing that should be produced through you is disciples of Jesus. I don't have to tell you that Jesus told us to go and make disciples. We know that was the great commission that he has given us. And ultimately, to make disciples, what we have to do is love people. We just talked about that is the fruit that God has called us to show. But also, we got to share the gospel with them and disciple them. Sharing gospel is, Jesus compares to planting seeds in Matthew chapter 13. And he tells us in that parable that sometimes the seeds are going to take root and become a plant, and sometimes the seeds are not. In fact, he tells us that three out of the four soils that that seed lands in will not produce fruit. But here's what he says about the last one. The seed falling on good soil refers to someone who hears the word and understands it. This is the one who produces the crop, yielding 100, 60, or 30 times what was sown. If we are planting the seeds, you can expect that it's not always going to land on good soil. But if it does land on good soil, it's going to yield a crop 160 or 30 times what was sown. That's called reproduction. That's called producing. That's what we are called to do. But then also, when we reach someone with the gospel, we share the seeds of the gospel, we plant the seeds of the gospel with them, we don't just need to leave them on their by themselves and say good luck. We need to walk with them. It's interesting to me that any job that we do, there's a training period. They're going to set you up with a mentor. They're going to set you up with someone that's going to walk you through how to do the job. I remember doing that at Food Lion. I did it multiple times for new people that were working at Food Lion. You show them the ropes on how it is to be done. And it's a shame to me that we don't do that in the church. And I'm looking at myself. This has been on our leadership notes. We had our leadership meeting this past Monday, and it's been on our leadership notes for months now about setting up something that will help us when someone commits their life to Jesus that we disciple them. And ultimately for that to happen, we need you guys to be producing. We need to be able to set them up with you guys to be able to disciple them and show them the ropes. Because the truth is, this walk with Jesus is more important than any job you'll ever have on earth. And those jobs see the seriousness of you doing your work right, and they'll train you. Shouldn't we see the seriousness of doing this walk with God right? Because this is not a job, this is a war. And you're not going to send someone into a battlefield not knowing what they're doing. You're going to send someone in the battlefield being trained up to know how to live. And that's what we should be doing. We should be discipling people. We should be teaching them the ways of Jesus. And that's something we are working on as a church, to set something up where we're able to have a clear-cut process that when someone commits their life to Jesus, we set them up with this person who disciples them and walks with them there in that first year or longer. So, as followers of Jesus, we're called to produce goodness in this world, disciples of Jesus, and the last one is a lasting impact. So, talking about the similarities between the plants create beauty in the world, the plants reproduce according to their species, we should be reproducing disciples, and then the last one is when a plant dies, all those nutrients return to the ground. We're going to have a bunch of leaves fall down to the ground. And as much as people like to get them up and put them out in the woods, they say to cut them up and leave them in the yard because it returns nutrients to the ground. Randy don't do nothing with them, right, Randy? No, I didn't think so. I imagine you raking them up and jumping in the big pile of leaves. If we do these two things, first things, we leave goodness in the world and we make disciples of Jesus, you will leave a lasting impact. You'll leave a lasting impact on your family, on your friends, and on the world. I thought about this. How many Christians today are Christians because their parents were Christians? And I'm not saying it in a bad way. I'm saying it in a way like I'm thankful that my parents raised me up in church. I'm thankful that they made me go to church. I'm thankful that even in my teenage years when I was a little rebellious and didn't want to get up and didn't want to go, they still made me. Because it set me in that pattern, and I heard the truth, and I knew what it was important to worship God, and because of that, I think that's why I'm here today. I have heard stories from people who didn't grow up in church. Parents didn't have them in church, and that just blows my mind. But we, as parents to children, which, by the way, we're expecting our second one April 23rd. As parents of children, we need to be raising them up in church. We need to be raising them up as followers of Jesus. We need to have them in church so that we set the example for them so that, you know, we're leaving a lasting impact. And ultimately, when you talk about a lasting impact, it's not just an impact here on earth, but it's an internal impact. I want to have as many people as possible that I know join me in heaven. And I hope you do too. I hope that, once again, we can't understand eternity in our finite minds, but when you think about eternity, think about if let's say that this age lasts a lot longer than any of us think it's going to. Think about all the people that you could be welcoming into heaven because of the impact that you're making. We do that by making disciples and making a positive impact in the world. Because everyone dies, just like plants die. The plants return their nutrients to the ground. I have done my fair share of funerals, and it's one of those things of pastoring that you don't like doing, but it's an honor to do them. I've been at the bedside of a couple people who passed away, and being the spiritual leader there, or however you want to view that, it's one of those places where the unseen world meets the seen. And as I've learned that a lot of times, I've told people before, I don't know what I'm doing bedside. Like, I'm not very good bedside. And I remember one guy that used to go to church here, he said, it's not about what you say, it's just about your presence here. And one of the things that they've taught us in school was that people, I mean, whether it's right or wrong, when they view the pastor there, when the pastor is there, they view Jesus as being there. And while the pastor is not Jesus, I mean, I get that to some degree, that there's a spiritual presence there. And same thing with the funerals. That's why pastors do funerals. It's interesting to me that they get pastors to do funerals, and a lot of people are now getting non-pastors to do weddings. That don't make sense to me. You care about a pastor being there when they die, but not necessarily when they're living. We'll get to that some other time. But I've done my fair share of funerals. And it's really made me think about what are they going to say at my funeral when I die. And so I want to ask you this. What are they going to say at your funeral when you die? I've been in funerals where countless people talk about the impact that that person that is dead has made in their life. I've been at funerals where they talk about the impact that they made. They're going to be in heaven because that person reached them, got them the church, or so on and so forth. What are they going to say at yours? What's your kids going to say at yours? How many people are going to be there because of the impact you made? But ultimately, how many people will be in heaven because of you? Something to think about. As followers of Jesus, we are called to produce. On day three, God created the land which would serve as the foundation for plants that would reproduce. He formed the foundation for us to produce as Christians as well. And as Christians, we are called to produce goodness, disciples of Jesus, / the seeds of gospel to others, and by leaving an eternal impact. At the end of the day, I want to tell you a story of one man who you've heard of because we celebrate this day in March, St. Patrick's Day. Is that March? You've heard of St. Patrick, but you might not know exactly why there is a St. Patrick's Day. And they've secularized it now, but St. Patrick was not just someone that we gave a name to, goes with saint. He was a legit good guy, a good Christian, a good follower of Jesus. And he produced good in the world, he produced disciples of Jesus, and he made a lasting impact that is still there today. There's a portrait of him, and I'll get to the snakes in a bit here to explain that. But St. Patrick was born British, and in 401, he was 16 years old, and he was kidnapped by Irish raiders. And he was taken to Ireland as a slave, and he spent 6 years as what they would call a shepherd slave. So he was a slave working under a master, but he would serve as a shepherd. And that was a lonely life. Shepherding's not fun. But Patrick, he had a dream of escaping. And he convinced some sailors to let him board their ship. And eventually, he survived, I think, a 2-year journey back to Britain, where he was united with his family. His parents were, of course, happy to have him back, as any parents would be, and they told him not to leave again. But one night, as he was sleeping, he had a dream. Or in this dream, or a vision, there's a man that he knew from Ireland that appears holding a letter. And that letter is called The Voice of the Irish. The young man then hears a voice of multitude crying, "We beg you to come and walk among us once more." That was not the only vision he had. He kept having visions of the Irish asking him to come back. And so eventually he did as one of the first Christian missionaries to Ireland. Through his ministry, the Irish would rapidly embrace the Christian faith. His ministry led to the establishment of over 300 churches and the baptism of over 120,000 individuals, profoundly influencing Irish society. One of the legends is that he cast all the snakes out of Ireland. And probably not true, could be, but probably not true. But one of the legends is that he, through the power that God gave him, cast all the snakes out of Ireland. So that's why you see him pointing to snakes. And I don't know if that's true, but what I do know is that he made an eternal difference in 120,000 individuals. More than that, though, because he planted, helped start 300 churches who are still doing ministry today, probably many of them. Not only that, but by the time of his death, Christianity has been established across Ireland. Remember how I talked about where Christians are producing and living the way they should be living, they should be producing good? Well, because Christianity has been established across Ireland, the Irish slave trade has ended. Murder and intertribal warfare have significantly decreased. And Ireland was left in a better place than it was before he got there. Can we say the same thing about you? I'm not saying that we have to have a St. Patrick type impact. But are you impacting your family? Are you impacting your friends? Are you impacting your workplace? Are you impacting your church? Are you impacting this world in a way that brings the goodness of God, the life that God wants to live, into this area? As Christians, that's what you're called to do. My prayer is that we would do it. Amen? It is 12 o'clock on the dot, so I'm going to pray, and then we're going to be released here. Because the application for today is not to come up here and worship, it's to worship with your life, to leave here and to produce, to make disciples, produce goodness in this world, and to leave a lasting impact. So let's pray. Holy Father,